Understanding the threat from Ebola, Triple E, and other infectious diseases in and out of the news. Yesterday, health officials in Dallas cleared 43 people who had had contact with Thomas Eric Duncan, the first person to die in the U.S. from Ebola. The news comes after weeks of fear, and in some cases, hysteria, about this serious disease which has been so deadly in Liberia and Sierra Leone. Here in Maine, there have been no reported cases of Ebola, but earlier this month, the state marked its first confirmed case of Triple E in a human, a disease that so far this year has claimed two lives in New Hampshire. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss Triple E, Ebola, and other infectious diseases with three doctors who study them closely. Maine Calling offers an assessment of our risk from infectious disease. But first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Despite what you may be hearing on the news over the past few weeks, Ebola is not the only infectious disease our healthcare providers are treating and preparing for. The flu, Triple E, pertussis, Lyme disease, and chikungunya are other infectious diseases that are on the radar of the medical community. Today, we have three experts joining us to explain what steps Maine has taken to prepare and protect against infectious diseases. They'll answer your questions about Ebola and the likelihood of it showing up in Maine, and they'll explain what steps you can and should be taking. They'll share with you what you can do to lessen the chances that you'll catch one of the more common illnesses that typically start cropping up this time of year. With me in the studio, Dr. August Valenti. He is an infectious disease specialist at Maine Medical Center. And joining us from our studio in Augusta, Dr. Sheila Panette, director of the Maine Centers for Disease Control, and Dr. Christopher Pizzullo. He is a pediatrician and medical director for Maine CDC's Division of Population Health. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about Ebola, Triple E, or other infectious diseases? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, that's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can send us a tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to you all, and thank you for being here.
Nice to see you, Jennifer.
Thanks, Jennifer. It's a privilege to be here with you all.
Thank you, Jennifer.
I want to start by asking each of you this. What do you want the public to understand about Ebola? Dr. Valenti.
Well, the first thing we want them to understand is that there have been no cases in Maine. The second thing we want them to understand is that there have been no community-acquired cases to date in the United States. The third thing we want them to understand is that it is really important for us to learn about the disease and to exercise prudence and caution in dealing with at-risk populations. So that includes our immigrant populations here in the state. We're very concerned that there may be inappropriate backlash in this setting. So those are three of the things that I think are key. The other thing I want to say is that in epidemics, it's very important for us to remember that communications are key. And so programs like this we're so grateful for the opportunity to try to get the facts out there. Division and derision and criticism of people who are working day and night to try to keep the population of Maine safe never helps in an epidemic. And then third, we on this side of things very much appreciate the perceptions out there. And I can tell you, having spoken with people at the medical center as well as ordinary citizens and my patients, there's a lot of concern.
Dr. Panette, what about you? What is it that you want people to understand today about Ebola?
The most important thing I want people to understand is that, one, we understand their concern, we understand their fears, but our highest priority is to the people, their safety and the people of Maine. It's our responsibility to help educate them and inform them with facts, and we are actively preparing to expect the unexpected. We are cooperating and communicating with our federal, state, and local partners on a regular basis, and we are taking our guidance from the federal CDC. First, most importantly, we do not have an epidemic in the United States of America. People need to know this is an epidemic within three countries of West Africa: Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Ebola is a viral illness. It's spread by contact with an infected symptomatic individual via direct contact with their blood and bodily secretions such as urine, stool, mucus, sweat, semen, or breast milk. And the risk is really increased amongst those people who have direct contact, in particular their healthcare providers. And we are all learning from the experience in Texas. We know that an individual did come from Liberia to the United States and did get ill. That patient was cared for by healthcare professionals in the United States, and those two providers have been diagnosed with Ebola and are being treated at this time. The individual who had the disease did pass away. It's important for us to understand that in the United States, we have a very sophisticated public health infrastructure. We have a healthcare system unlike that in West Africa. And we are working very hard on a daily basis with our hospitals, our regional resource centers, and the federal CDC to make sure that we are diligently prepared and have the ability to communicate this message to you.
All right. And Dr. Pizzullo, what would you like to add?
I think all my talking points have been taken.
Well, that's fine. Let me follow up with this then. How certain is the medical community that Ebola can only be transmitted by bodily fluids? We hear this over and over and over again, yet the photojournalist working for NBC says he doesn't know how he contracted the virus. He says he thought he was being careful, thought he was keeping a good distance from people.
So let me I'll put my two cents in here. I want to point out, as Sheila has said so eloquently, that there have been no community cases here in the United States. We know that a lot of lay people were exposed to the index case, and yet today,
when you say the index case, you mean Thomas Eric Duncan, or
that's correct, Mr. Duncan, and only healthcare workers have gotten it so far. A lot of what is being said in the media comes from people who are doing investigations on Ebola. For instance, we know that there is a possibility for the aerosolization of fluids. Aerosols are different than an airborne disease. To date, there is no evidence that it is airborne. And I think that's a very important point to make. That doesn't mean that the virus is not going to mutate, although many experts tell us that they don't think it will become airborne. It's just not the nature of the virus, but that remains to be seen. So I think we have to be very careful about speculating that it's airborne.
Okay. I want to read from you. This was handed to me right before I came on the air. Breaking news from the federal government, new travel restrictions. And I'm going to read what Secretary Johnson, DHS Secretary Johnson, announced just this morning, late this morning. Today, I am announcing that all passengers arriving in the United States whose travel originates in Liberia, Sierra Leone, or Guinea will be required to fly into one of the five airports that have enhanced screening and additional resources in place. Chris Pizzullo, do you think that this is prudent?
I think it's absolutely prudent. I think it's really important that when these particular visitors fly into the United States, that we're able to monitor and sort of maintain a level of security for ourselves.
And I just want to say the five airports that are being the major screen for these individuals coming from West Africa are Newark, Washington, D.C., Dulles, Atlanta, Chicago O'Hare, and JFK. And we know that 50% of those individuals do fly into JFK. And so that will have about 94% of the population covered. And it's important to know that they're screening very thoroughly. They're asking questions. They are giving them a checklist. They are taking their temperature. But the incubation period is 21 days. So they have set up guidelines for these individuals. They give them care packs, and they will be checking their temperature twice a day. And each state at the final destination of the individual will be notified as to the arrival to that state, and the healthcare departments will be calling and having close contact and conversation on a daily basis with the individuals once they've entered the country.
A school district in Maine, as you know, MSAD 58, has placed a teacher on leave because she was at a conference in Dallas. Dr. Valenti, what do you think of that response?
May I use the word silly? So if people drive through Dallas, they're not going to be exposed to Ebola. My understanding is that this particular woman was 10 miles away from the hospital in Dallas. So there's no scientific or rational basis for that kind of concern. I do think, again, that people's perceptions are terribly important. We saw this in the H1N1 outbreak, and some of us are old enough to remember the original AIDS outbreak.
I remember it.
You remember it, Sheila.
I was living in San Francisco.
You remember all of the irrational behavior surrounding that. So we really want to make sure that people understand that you don't get a disease like Ebola from this kind of contact. And I think that was an inappropriate move on the part of the school system.
This is Dr. Panetta. I'll say that the Maine CDC's role is to provide information and share guidance from the federal CDC regarding Ebola, which is what we did share with the school district.
And Dr. Panetta, I want to ask you about, there was a patient, and maybe Dr. Valenti, you're a better person to ask. I'm not sure. The patient who was isolated at Maine Medical Center, but why was that person released? Was it because they had reached that 21-day window that, you know, that if you have Ebola, the symptoms will show within these 21 days?
Yes, that's the reason that that patient was released. And I should also say that we worked very closely with the Maine CDC. Most of the infectious diseases specialists in the state have tremendous access to the Maine CDC. We have a very collaborative effort. They were very, very helpful right up through the Commissioner of Health, and we were all in close contact.
And how did that work? Is there a testing lab here in Maine that has the capability of testing for Ebola, or were they sent to the CDC in Atlanta? How does it, not only for this patient, but any potential future patients, how would those patients be tested for Ebola?
That's in flux. So right now, our state lab is not licensed by the federal government to test. We do have a laboratory in Massachusetts that can do the testing. All Ebola testing that's final has to be approved by the federal CDC.
And the one patient that was in Portland and was at Maine Medical Center and being watched, was that person tested for Ebola?
A test was sent, but after the clinical presentation was given to the feds, and I was on that conversation along with Dr. Panette and I think Commissioner Mayhew, the feeling was that it did not need to be tested. The patient didn't meet the criteria, and so a blood test was never done.
Okay. I want to switch gears a little bit, Dr. Panette, and talk to you about Triple E. We've had a confirmed case in Maine this year. I understand it's not the first time there's been a confirmed human case in Maine.
It's the first reported on a Maine resident. My understanding is in 2008, there was a case of a New Hampshire individual, a mature adult visiting the state, spending the summer in our state, who we believe acquired Triple E, was hospitalized here and did pass away.
And are we out of the clear so far this season because we've had cold weather? Are there still mosquitoes out there that could be infected?
Well, there are still mosquitoes out there that could be infectious. However, under 45 degrees, usually mosquitoes are not very active. So okay. It's been 36 and 38 at my house.
Right. And let me ask you this. Because you have one confirmed case, do you suspect there are others that have not been reported, that someone didn't feel well but didn't know what it was?
Right, because as you know, Eastern equine encephalitis can present in two ways, and you can have those minor where they don't feel very well, but they don't go on to actually develop encephalitis. Those people usually are not hospitalized. The people who are hospitalized are those that develop high fevers, meningitis-like symptoms, encephalitis. They can get seizures. They become very confused, oftentimes go on to have respiratory support. And so that of those that are affected, that can be approximately 30% of the population, and then of those that are affected, 30% of them are left oftentimes with neurologic sequela to some degrees, and that is pretty broad in terms of what that deficit is.
Dr. Pezzullo, I'd like to bring you back into the conversation and talk
sure.
about the flu. I know that every year the recommendations seem to shift a little bit about who should be vaccinated. Who are we talking about should be vaccinated this year, and in what way?
Well, from my perspective, it doesn't really change. Really, we should be attempting to immunize the entire population. Those at greatest risk, though, certainly we should highlight. So certainly people who are elderly, people who are very young, under the age of 2 years old, and people who are either immunocompromised or have some sort of a lung illness, for example, asthma, those would be sort of the key populations to immunize.
And we've already had a confirmed case in Maine, correct?
Yes, our state lab has confirmed one case already. We have also had a handful of cases that have been proven through a rapid test in physicians' offices. So it is now in Maine.
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to learn what else you all are keeping an eye on, and this one that I'm having a hard time pronouncing here, chikungunya. And also, we're going to take calls from the public. So stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Silly's in Portland's East End, open at 11 Tuesday through Friday and at 9 for brunch on the weekends, with vegan and gluten-free options, Silly's.com, and Dean Wealth Advisors, independent investment advice to individuals, families, and institutions, DEIGHAN.com.
MPBN's final two Your Vote 2014 debates take place this week, and once again we are asking questions submitted by the public. If you have a question for the candidates for U.S. Senate or for governor, please email them as soon as possible to yourvote@mpbn.net. That's yourvote@mpbn.net. And then don't forget to watch or listen Wednesday at 8 for the Senate debate, Thursday at 8 for the gubernatorial debate, and of course online at mpbn.net. And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, infectious diseases. With me in the studio, Dr. August Valenti. He is an infectious disease specialist at Maine Medical Center. In our studio in Augusta, we have the director of the Maine Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Sheila Panette, and Dr. Christopher Pezzullo. He is a pediatrician and medical director for Maine's CDC Division of Population Health. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I want to get to your calls and emails in just a second, but first I want to talk about some of the other diseases we're keeping an eye on, medical personnel are keeping an eye on. Dr. Valenti, during the break you mentioned enterovirus. Tell us about it.
Well, each year this time of year, we begin to see problems with enteroviruses. There's been a new enterovirus that has been spreading around the country. We actually have had at least one case that I'm aware of in Maine. This virus is known as enterovirus D68. It's particularly treacherous for youngsters with respiratory illnesses such as asthma, but it has also been associated with paralysis of the limbs. So we're seeing this in a number of states, and perhaps Dr. Pezzullo wants to comment on at least the one case we saw here in Maine.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, so, I'm going to sort of couple it with some of the thoughts that Dr. Valenti had, is that this seems to be a virus that's really most of concern for children with, lung disease or asthma. So it seems that for those healthy individuals who don't have risk factors, it's really going to probably be just a cold, an upper respiratory infection. But there is a small handful of people who it seems to attack fairly strenuously. And what we're really trying to guide parents is that make sure that if your children have asthma, that they have an asthma plan, that you've discussed that with your physicians, that you have a plan for what to do when your child is sick. The goal is for them to be well-controlled asthmatics prior to getting sick. But certainly if they do get a significant infection like EVD-68, make sure that they have an acute plan. What medicines will they use? How will they use them? Make sure that they let their physician know if their child seems to be significantly more involved with their asthma than usual.
So that's, so many kids in Maine have asthma. One of my kids does. So what we need to do is talk with a pediatrician and say, at what point should I bring my child in to see you? What point is that cold bad enough that we need to bring somebody into the pediatrician?
That's right. Many of the symptoms of EVD-68 can be very broad, but with the severe symptoms, usually the children goes from feeling pretty healthy and rapidly gets ill with shortness of breath, wheezing, difficulty breathing, retraction of their intercostal muscles, nasal flaring, sometimes can have a fever, not all the time, and their color just doesn't look good. I mean, there's a dramatic change in how they appear. I will say that since this started in mid-August in the nation, we've seen about 825 cases in 46 states, so it's a pretty big nationwide outbreak. The first time it was ever diagnosed in the United States was actually in 1962 when we had a cluster in California of 4 cases of pneumonia in children. You need to know that this is not an illness that's usually reported to the federal CDC because enteroviruses tend to be very common, but when they happen in clusters such as this one, where 15% of the children nationally were being admitted to ICUs and on oxygen support, that's when they started to identify the particular strain because there's about 100 different types of enterovirus. The most important thing to remember is that when your child gets sick, especially if they have asthma or historeactive airway, you need to keep a close eye on them, keep them home from school, pay attention to the asthma plan, be in contact with their pediatrician. Make sure you're washing your hands 20 seconds with soap and water. Purell doesn't cut the cake. Make sure you're bleaching surfaces because it does live on hard surfaces. And make sure that you're not doing a lot of hugging because that can actually spread the infection.
And that was one of the things I was going to ask. How does enterovirus spread? Is it typical ways? Touching, sneezing?
Yep.
Everything.
Yep. How everything
spreads.
Respiratory droplets, yeah. Right.
Okay, I think we're going to bring the listeners in now. We're going to start in Bangor with Kathy. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My name is Kathy Day, and I'm a retired nurse, and I now work as a patient safety advocate, and it's always really good to hear the comments from some of the leaders in the state. It's important to recognize that patient safety and nurse safety go hand in hand, so I have two questions, and my first is, how has preparedness for Ebola changed in Maine hospitals since the 4 actively infected patients touched down at the Bangor airport from Africa, and are those changes mandated? The second part of that question is, why are there no frontline caregivers who actually care for infected patients on the statewide panel for Maine Ebola preparedness? And my second question is, why are there never alerts or media focus when there are MRSA or C. diff outbreaks in Maine hospitals?
Okay, let's start them one at a time. Your first question, Kathy, was how have Maine hospitals practices changed since 4 patients touched down in Bangor? Dr. Panette, tell us about that incident and if you could answer Kathy's question.
Kathy, thank you for your question. As you know, we have an infrastructure that has been established, emergency preparedness after 9/11. So we have been building and establishing an infrastructure for emergency preparedness for some time. The actual incidents regarding the transport of those patients from West Africa, there was lots of questions asked. That was a mission that was controlled by the federal CDC and the State Department, and the doors of the plane where the individual was contained were never opened, so the risk to the public was not present.
Okay,
and so
go ahead.
We have been actively working, knowing when the outbreak started last March, we have been actively working with our hospitals, our EMS, and our regional resource centers, and our regional hospitals to train, educate, and enhance our preparedness.
And Kathy, your second question was about MRSA. Could you repeat that?
I wondered why there are never alerts or media focus when there are MRSA or C. diff outbreaks in Maine's hospitals. And the reason I ask that is that my father was the third of three to contract MRSA in his tiny critical access hospital in less than a month. And they all died as a result, yet no outbreak was ever reported. The public didn't know, and no changes in protocol were made at that hospital. Shouldn't there be real-time reporting and that information shared with patients and the public?
So, Kathy, I know Kathy Day quite well, and she has been a great advocate for MRSA patients in Maine. Let me just point out that first of all, MRSA is now endemic, and we see a lot of it coming in from the community. That might be one issue. I am very glad that you asked this question, though, Kathy, because there are many other infectious diseases that are more important, if you will, right now than Ebola to people in America. And that brings up the whole issue of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. As Kathy is aware, MRSA, which is methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, is only one of those. There are now very resistant gram-negative organisms that are likely to be discovered by hospitals, but are causing infections, very serious infections, in patients around the country. So your point about the importance of infections other than Ebola is very, very well taken. Again, I want to point out to you that hospitals do report MRSA. The state keeps an eye on MRSA infections. And a number of us, as you know, have taken various steps within our hospitals to try to protect patients from getting MRSA. But unfortunately, as you know, it is endemic in the community. Community strains come into the hospital, and we do screening at Maine Med. Not every hospital in Maine believes in the technique that we use, and about 50% of infectious diseases people in the country are divided. At Maine Medical Center and other hospitals in Maine, we use what we call a search and destroy strategy. That is, we actually screen our patients. If they're positive for colonization, which means that the organism lives on the patient but doesn't cause an infection, those patients are placed on precautions, isolation, so that we don't spread the disease to other patients. However, universal precautions and standard precautions, which are recommended by the Centers for Disease Control, have been applied at other institutions, and this is a matter of national debate.
But to Kathy's question, she wanted to know if outbreaks or clusters were being reported to the public. Is your point by saying it's endemic, by saying there are not clusters or outbreaks now, you can assume that MRSA is in the hospital if you are in the hospital?
Yes, invasive outbreaks would be reported to the state. So, for instance, if there were a cluster of a real cluster, an epidemiologic cluster of surgical patients who broke out with MRSA, that would be an epidemiologic incident. And that's the kind of thing that we would be working with the state and federal CDC to control.
And Dr. Panette, is that public information? Is that something that journalists could be reporting on if we looked at your website?
We do track MRSA and C. diff, and thanks to Kathy's advocacy, she is one of the people that did actually go to legislators and encourage that we had legislation. And so we do now, as of 2011, have legislation to track with our hospitals MRSA and C. diff. It is a public record. Since we have advocated this particular tracking mechanisms, and as Dr. Valenti talked about the many precautions and testing, we have decreased by a significant amount the number of people with MRSA with central lines and urinary catheters. So we are making strides in that area right now.
Kathy, thanks so much for calling in. We're going to go now to Hollowell and Erica. Hi, Erica. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to say on the same day on my local paper that they had the story about the teacher being suspended for 21 days, there was what I think is a much greater health risk to our nation, which is the very low vaccination rate for children. I have three young children who are in school or will be shortly, and I'm astounded that over 5% of the entering kindergartners have not been immunized, and that whooping cough is coming back, and I'm very concerned about this as a public health risk. So I'm wondering if the panelists could speak to that at all.
Dr. Pizzullo, I have a feeling you have an opinion about this.
Yes, I do. So certainly my opinion is that we should be immunizing our children to try to prevent these diseases, many of which seem to be almost completely eradicated in our country from sort of returning again. And one the caller did mention was pertussis. There does seem to be sort of globally, there's been an increase in pertussis since about 2012. In Maine, although this year I will say it does seem to be sort of leveling off, but still the rate seems to be too high. For some reason, people feel that it would be better to not immunize and let their children perhaps get the illness on their own. But it's important to remember that pertussis can be a very significant illness, especially for the very young child. So it can be deadly for children who are under a year old. The problem with pertussis, too, is that it seems to sort of remain in communities because adults and older children can have milder forms of the illness. You know, it's important now for when adults receive their every 10-year tetanus vaccine that they now receive those vaccines that have a pertussis in them so that they are prevented from being able to catch pertussis and spread it to the rest of the community.
And I want to comment that back in 2008, we had a universal vaccine program stop, and we started to see the numbers increase when we reinstituted it, a universal vaccine program for children, in an effort to reduce financial barriers to vaccination. We have seen our immunization rate increase. We are actively working with vaccine coalitions and many of the healthcare systems to encourage and educate patients about the importance of immunization, because immunization is one of our top 10 public health accomplishments in the last century that has not only saved many, many lives, decreased hospitalization, and also both indirect and direct healthcare cost.
Dr. Panette, when you say that Maine used to have a universal vaccine program that went away and came back, that means that everyone, regardless of income, had a chance to get their children vaccinated, yes?
That is correct.
Okay.
And I want to make a comment about the report that was put out. The report only had 85% of people, participants reporting, and that was from public schools. We do know that there's homeschool children, and we also know that there's private schools, and they are not mandated to report. We also know that by the time most children reach seventh grade, most of those children, probably less than 2%, have not been immunized.
All right. Well, thank you. If the phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to take another short break. And when we return, more of your comments and questions for the doctors. Thank you.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston. Committed to 100% wind-powered beer production, baxterbrewing.com. Casella. Dedicated to improving air quality for all Mainers through a commitment to reduce its carbon footprint, Casella, giving resources new life. And Finance Authority of Maine, committed to expanding business and education opportunities by investing in Mainers' success. FameMaine.com.
Intelligence Squared US, where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues.
A unanimous Supreme Court told us that digital is different.
This is not a question, I think, as a democracy that we should leave up to five elderly people on the Supreme Court.
The next motion up for debate, does the mass collection of phone records violate the Fourth Amendment?
Join us for that following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock.
This is Nora Flaherty, your host for All Things Considered here at MPBN, Maine Public Radio. Every day, you count on your public radio station to keep you informed about important events and issues in our world and country, and also to keep on top of what's going on here in Maine. Every evening at 5:30 on Maine Things Considered, we focus on our state, but now we're also making sure that whenever you tune into All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30, you'll also hear what's going on here in Maine. After all, that's important. So join me each evening for All Things Considered here on MPBN. Thanks a lot.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what you need to know about infectious diseases, including Ebola. With me in the studio, Dr. August Valenti. He is an infectious disease specialist at Maine Medical Center. From our studios in Augusta, Dr. Sheila Panette, who is director of the Maine Centers for Disease Control, and Dr. Christopher Pizzullo. He is a pediatrician and medical director for Maine CDC's Division of Population Health. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Dr. Valenti, if for whatever reason you suspect that you or someone in your family has contracted Ebola or any other infectious disease, enterovirus, should you come to the emergency room?
So unless you're acutely ill, what we're advocating, particularly in this time of concern of Ebola, it's best to call first. And the reason for that is so that we can prepare a receiving facility for a particular kind of infection.
And when you say call, call Maine Medical Center, call Eastern Maine Medical Center, or call your pediatrician or family doctor?
I'm a fan of calling the providers first. For people that don't have providers and who think that they may have been, and again, we don't want a lot of calls from the worried well, but if there's a serious concern, those people should be calling their providers, or they can call the emergency room so that we are prepared. We can question people first. In our own practice, we're asking people to call so that we can question them and screen them. Right now, everybody is being trained to screen for a travel history, particularly to the three countries that Sheila mentioned, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia, so that we can prepare for their entry.
Okay. Going to another call, headed up to Bucksport. And John, hi, John. Go ahead.
Yes. I have a granddaughter who lives in Calgary, and she has a lung disease, interstitial lung disease called NEHI, N-E-H-I. And I apologize, I don't know exactly what that stands for, but my concern was about the disease that ends in 68.
Oh, the enterovirus, right?
Yes. And now this child is on oxygen 24/7 because of this lung disease. So, you know, she already has rapid breathing and all the symptoms that the doctors talked about. How would someone like that, would you detect if ended up with this other disease?
Chris, you want to take that?
I'll take the first stab at that one. So what I would say is that if your granddaughter has this particular illness, she is, correct me if I'm wrong, she's probably being monitored not only by her, she probably has a primary care physician, she probably has a lung specialist, and she may also have some in-home support specialists? Is that true?
She doesn't have in-home support anymore, but...
Okay. But she has a specialist and a primary care physician.
Yeah.
So I think it would be very important for her parents to be able to speak with the primary care physician and make sure that they know, here's what our daughter's baseline is, here's how she's normally acting, here are the types of symptoms that we need to be concerned about when she's ill. And again, it gets back to that having a well plan and having a sick plan. We kind of think about this with a lot of chronic diseases, that it's important to know how you're taking care of the disease and sort of controlling it as best you can. But when something happens, like an infection, say EVD 68, what are you doing? What's your plan? Who do you call? What medicines do you start to implement? You know, what practices do you implement to keep your child safe? Do you bring her to the ER? Do you bring her to the specialist? So I think it's really important, especially because we know that this virus is currently in the United States, and you said she's in Canada, correct? That I think it's important to make sure that she has her sick plan and she knows that at the drop of a hat, what are the steps she should take if her child is becoming more ill compared to baseline?
Right, and more ill being increased shortness of breath, increased retractions, increased oxygen needs, and she just doesn't look good, and oftentimes they don't feel like eating.
John, thank you so much for your call, and good luck to your granddaughter. We're going to head now down to York. Joanne, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I have a plan to travel to South Africa in December, and I know it's geographically at a great distance from West Africa, but I haven't heard anything about Ebola traveling from the countries it's now into bordering countries in Africa. What's the prognosis on that? Is that a pretty protected border, or do the doctors think it could possibly, move into other countries in Africa, and how rapidly?
Well, good question. Traveling in Africa, a lot of people like to travel to Eastern and Southern Africa particularly.
So make sure you see a travel specialist. That's always important, and there are a number of travel specialists in Maine. There have been models that have been done by epidemiologists regarding the various countries at risk for potentially receiving Ebola patients. At this particular point, I'm not aware, perhaps Sheila is, but I'm not aware of whether or not South Africa has elected to restrict travel from affected countries. But that might be one way that you would be protected. In terms of protecting yourself, there doesn't appear to be transmission on airplanes. It is terribly important for people always to keep their hand hygiene at a maximum. Keep your hands clean and don't touch your face. That's very, very important. Frequent washing in airports and during travel is a very important thing to do. And that's the best way to protect yourself, quite frankly.
Would it be prudent to wear gloves if you're traveling on an international flight?
You're liable to worry your fellow passengers if you wear gloves, but no, I don't think that's necessary.
Okay. Joanne, thanks for your call. And Dr. Valenti, I want to go back to something we talked about a while ago, which was the patient who was under observation at Maine Medical Center. I'm looking at a couple of headlines that say that the patient tested negative for Ebola. Those headlines are inaccurate, right? That patient was never tested, but rather observed, and the 21 days went by.
The patient never had a blood test for Ebola. The testing, I think, that people perhaps misunderstood is that the patient passed the test of having no clinical illness, no fevers. The patient only had one fever during their entire hospital stay for the 21 days. And that might have been misinterpreted as a test. But no Ebola test was performed on this patient.
And that patient was under observation because he or she had been to Liberia and then showed a fever? Or what was the reason for the observation?
The reason for the observation is that the patient had returned from an area of Africa where Ebola had been previously. And the folks that were involved in this patient's care wanted to be very prudent to make sure that there was not a problem.
All right. We have a Facebook post from Jay, and Dr. Panette, I'll throw this one to you. Jay asks, will our nurses have the gear they need on hand when it's needed? Do our hospitals already have the correct PPE, personal protective equipment?
Personal protective equipment, healthcare workers are being asked to use has been working. Many of the hospitals are preparing. The newest guidance from the federal CDC as of yesterday was to enhance the guidance, and so we are asking hospitals that all healthcare workers undergo rigorous training and practice and be competent at personal protective equipment, and that no skin be exposed while wearing that, and that all workers are trained and supervised by a monitor while they're putting on and taking off the PPE. the patients treated at Emory University, Nebraska Medical Center, and NIH all followed those three principles, and none of their workers were contracted with the illness. Now, each regional resource center does have personal protective equipment to offer to hospitals, and some hospitals do have their own.
So the equipment, the PPE is not, the PPEs, however you refer to them, are not hanging in the closets in the hospitals now, but are in regional warehouses where they could get to the hospitals quickly? No, you're shaking your head, Dr. Valencia. Yeah,
some hospitals, the hospitals have them.
Yeah, so let me just say that at the Maine Medical Center, we've been preparing before any patient arrived in the United States with Ebola. We've been preparing at least since August. We decided as an institution that we were going to exceed the Federal Center for Disease Control guidelines. I did not agree with those guidelines, and so we elected to use maximal protection for our staff. And so we had the foresight to purchase available equipment. And when we had the patient come into Maine Medical Center, our ER staff was quickly brought up to speed on this. Many of these folks have experience with hazardous materials and hazardous infectious diseases. However, we also have a safety department that came in and made sure that the buddy system was being employed, because as most people are now aware, the highest period of risk is when you're getting the suit off. We completely disinfect that suit before anyone attempts to remove it. And then the suit is carefully removed by a buddy.
That sounds time consuming.
It is, actually. We ask that disinfection be at least 2 minutes. It takes 2 minutes for the disinfectant that we use to kill the virus. And then there's a very careful system of removing it. There is not one person that cares for one of these patients. There is at a minimum three. One is a spotter to make sure that there are no breaches in the infection control and personal protective equipment. And then there are other spotters that are watching to be sure that supplies are adequate, what have you.
We're going to go to Westbrook and Kirk. Go ahead, Kirk. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for the call. Doctor, I'm just mildly curious about the MRSA clusters. My understanding is that a lot of these clusters center around immigrants, kids being brought over here from Central America and Latin America. Is this true?
Who said that?
I'm just asking, is there any correlation to these MRSA clusters and children from away?
Sheila, you want to address that?
No, there is not. It's everywhere. MRSA is everywhere. It's carried on everybody's skin, regardless of your color.
There you go, Kirk. And we have an email from Bill. He writes, what is the possibility of Ebola being transmitted between people by mosquitoes?
This is a very, very interesting. There's no documented insect vector that we are aware of. That has been raised and has been looked at, but it is definitely not proven with Ebola.
Okay. And at the very beginning of the show, I asked about a disease that my producer told me about, chikungunya. What is that? And should we be concerned about it?
Well, if you're traveling now to the southeastern United States or to the Caribbean, there's a virus that seems to have come out of Africa named chikungunya. There are a number of viruses that we now treat in travelers. One of them is dengue fever, and chikungunya is a particularly severe form of a viral illness. The name itself means to be contorted. And that's what happens. People get joint aches and pains. They can develop a rash and a pretty severe illness. And sometimes the joint aches and pains can last for weeks to months and in some cases years. So it's a mosquito-borne illness in this particular case. And we do have the mosquitoes here in the United States that can transmit it. And we know there are American cases.
And
I think it's important to note that those mosquitoes that can carry chikungunya do not exist in the Northeast U.S.
yet.
That's correct. And it is the Aegis tiger mosquito. And there is not a mortality related with this particular infection either.
Well, we have just about a minute left, and I'm wondering what who wants to have some closing thoughts here, Dr. Panette, other than wash your hands, cover your mouth, practice good hygiene. What should people be thinking about as they head into this winter season?
Most important thing is the cornerstone of treatment is actually getting your immunization. Vaccines are critical to the health of our state. This year, we have selected a quadrivalent vaccine to be available. So we are covering H1N1 from 2009-2010. We're covering the swine flu, H3N2, from a previous 2012. And we also have two different strains of influenza B. So pretty broad coverage. And by getting immunized, it will take approximately 2 weeks for you to develop antibodies. And if you get sick during that time period, hopefully your illness would be a little bit less. And if you develop signs of the flu, make sure that you have a call with your primary care provider so you can talk about antiviral drugs and how to proceed from there.
Well, thank you so much, all three of you. Dr. Sheila Panette, Director of the Maine Centers for Disease Control. Dr. Christopher Pizzullo, a pediatrician and medical director for the Maine CDC's Division of Population Health. And Dr. August Valenti, an infectious disease specialist at Maine Medical Center. John Keimel ran the board today, and our volunteer Cindy Hahn answered your calls and helped to produce the program. We had additional help from Mal Leary in our Augusta studio. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on Maine Calling, join host Keith Shortall for a look at Mainers who go on medical missions to help those in need abroad. We'll hear from the author of a book about her journey to an orphanage in rural Cambodia and others who have traveled to countries around the world. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on MPBN.